It's still good morning. Welcome to another one of our ICA briefings, Institute for Contemporary Affairs at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. I don't know if you noticed, but our last briefing by the commander of Southern Command, General Gallant, received a great deal of attention in Haaretz because he disclosed the presence of Iranians in the Gaza Strip. So it seems our briefings are always a source of new information and new angles at looking at events that are transpiring in the Middle East around us. I think last time Brigadier General Yosef Cooperwasser appeared at the Jerusalem Center, we couldn't print the text. But now he has left his previous position as the head of research, senior head of analysis of Israeli military intelligence, and he's had a number of very important positions before that in the intelligence branch, particularly as the head intelligence officer of Israel's second of the Israeli Army's Central Command, prior to his promotion to being the head of analysis for the IDF. Of course, he has covered in this period of time some of the most important events that have transpired in the last number of years, from the events with the Palestinians, the Second Intifada, the period of Operation Defensive Shield, and particularly the events in the East, like the Iraq War, and, of course, Iran. Today, we have asked Brigadier General Cooperwasser to speak about Iran's vulnerability and the implications of that vulnerability for the West as a whole. And I'm sure, given his rich background in dealing with Iran's involvement in the region over the last five or six years, he will have information that's very important for all of us. Just a few other points. Recently, Brigadier General Cooperwasser was a fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Today, he is vice president of Global CST, a security company. He has a BA in economics and Arabic from Haifa University, MA in economics from Tel Aviv University, and the list just goes on. So without further ado, I will ask General Cooperwasser to deliver his talk.
Thanks, Dory. Thank you very much. One thing is problematic is what you said, and this is that each such a meeting provides some new information. It's a challenge. I hope I will not provide new information, but only new way of looking at those things that we all know. But it doesn't seem that we always take the right steps, even though we know the situation. And talking about Iran, I think it's worthwhile to start with the beginning in order to understand what's happening. Going back to the revolution, to the Iranian revolution, because Iran, when we speak about Iran, and when I say the word Iran, I mean the Iranian regime, because there are many people in Iran and everyone has his own idea about how things should be going. Iran is a revolutionary regime. That's something that we have to keep in mind when we talk about it. Many people, when they deal with the Iranians, believe that you can convince them to adopt our kind of logic. But when you deal with a revolutionary entity, it is very difficult to find ways to their mind, because most people in the West have stopped to be revolutionaries ages ago. And it's very difficult to understand how a revolutionary mind works. And ever since 79, this regime has not ceased to be a revolutionary regime. They are in the midst of a revolutionary endeavor they've taken upon themselves. And it doesn't stop by changing the regime in Iran. The Iranian revolution is not only an Iranian revolution, it's an Islamic revolution. And that's why the mission that the Iranian revolution has deals with changing the world, not changing Iran. There are some steps after changing Iran. First of all, you have to change Iran in order to have a base to work from. Then you change the region. Then you change the world. And this is what this revolution is all about. There are many questions that the revolution is facing ever since it came to power about what is the right way to move forward and how you balance between national necessities and revolutionary necessities. And these tensions, in many cases, have forced the Iranians to push a little bit weaker on the revolutionary activities. And there were times when the Iranians felt that the pressures are such that they have to focus on national issues. But this is not the case since somewhere in the second half of the last decade, and definitely not in the last few years. The Iranians clearly feel, and this the fact that Khatami, who was representing the idea that national interest should come first, lost power, is a clear message from the Iranian regime that the international revolution should proceed with full capacity, and that national interests are not necessarily right now in contradiction with the international revolution. The other thing that we have to remember is, what is this international revolution all about? It's not only about power sharing. To a large extent, it is about power sharing. They do want Iran to have a stronger position in the world. And not only Iran. Iran is a representative of Islam. And Islam in the way they understand Islam, the way they interpret Islam. Because they are radical Muslims, as we all know, the regime. But the focus of this revolution has to deal with two elements. One is the question of justice. What Ahmadinejad is saying all the time is that justice should be done. And the situation we are living in is a situation where Islam is a victim of a plot against it by the international arrogance. This is the word used by Ahmadinejad, international arrogance. The international arrogance is doing everything within its capacity to make sure that the Muslims would not be able to be where they should be, to get the kind of treatment by the international community that they should get. The international arrogance is committed to keep the Muslims as blue-collar workers, to exploit their resources, the oil and so on and so forth, and to force upon them, in the context of this plot, all kinds of political regimes and political realities, like, for example, the existence of the State of Israel, that would serve the international community in keeping the world order the way it is. That's why justice has to be done. We have to fix this problem. Now, the main question is, what is the meaning of justice? How do we know when justice is done? This leads us to the second part, or this leads us to the power-sharing issue that I mentioned before. When the power will be shared in a different way, then we shall know that justice is done. But, as I said, justice is not the only issue. The other issue they fight for is this idea of what are the values upon which the world order should be built. And they do not accept the set of values upon which the Western world has established the world order. The entire idea of accountability, the entire idea of the laws of war, how wars should be fought, the entire idea of the elements that we believe in, liberty, human rights, mainly the idea that the purpose of states is to ensure the capabilities of their citizens to pursue happiness. This idea is unacceptable. They come up with a totally different set of ideas that they took from their own culture, and this is why even Khatami at this time suggested that there's going to be, there should be some sort of a cultural dialogue, and that the Iranian values are superior to those of the West, of course. This, the idea of having cultural dialogue is in order to teach the West what are the right values, to save the West from the strange ideas that it has developed. And this revolution stands for these values. We have to understand that. One of them, for example, is Vilayat Faqih. But it's a full set. And the idea of Vilayat Faqih is that the Lord is the one that produces, that has produced already. It's not produces anymore. Because there's a big question about whether ijtihad is something that is legitimate or not. Well, can you come up with something new today? And this is why they are fundamentalists. Because they believe that everything was already invented. And the Lord has already said his word, and we just have to interpret it here and there and know what to do right now. And this has implications on everything that they are struggling for. Now, when they speak about the world order that they want to change, and talking about implications for the West, what are we ready to do as Westerners in order to defend our values? They, for example, as I said before, do not accept the idea of how wars should be fought. From their point of view, this is a part of the plot, the way wars are being fought. If wars were to be confined to violence between combatants, this would eternalize the control of the West and eternalize the prevailing world order. That's why this should be changed. Wars should be fought against civilians. It's not even every war. In every war, civilians were affected. But in their perception, civilians are the main target. And that's something we have to understand, because we face Hamas that gets it, and Fatah and everybody that gets a lot of Iranian support. And we face, of course, Hezbollah. This support comes with this idea. The fact that Hezbollah launched rockets against civilians for 34 days in the last war, this was done by people, all of whom have gone through the Iranian brainwashing machine. And came up with it, and none of them have felt that something is wrong with that. Because this is the idea, that this is the way wars should be fought. I say it because, obviously, a lot has been said about, would the Iranians use the nuclear weapon if they have it or not? They don't have the same inhibitions that some other, especially Western societies, have about doing so. For them, killing civilians is totally legitimate. Moreover, even killing Muslims is legitimate. Because, first of all, some of them are to be announced as non-Muslims, and some of them will find a ways to way to heaven, because the important thing is the next world, not necessarily this one. I recommend by that, in this respect, for those who didn't read the article by Noah Feldman and in the New York Times some few months ago, I don't remember exactly, but about the logic of using nuclear power by Muslims, by radical Muslims. It's a very good article. And but it's true that the inhibitions are not there. Secondly, the idea of accountability. They fight against it. And they try all the time to create more areas where non-accountability can prevail. That's because accountability means that somebody is responsible for the use of force. Their idea is don't be responsible for your user force. In the case of the Karin A, for example, the people that gave the weapons to the Fatah were so cautious as to scrap the serial numbers of all the weapons they gave to the Fatah just to make sure that Iran would not be accountable for what is going to happen with these weapons. And again, they do it all the time. And these are the main elements in which the world order should be changed. Eventually, one of the elements in which it should be changed, it's the sharing of power. And Iran should become a superpower. And if one of the characteristics of a superpower is that it has a nuclear weapon, then Iran should be entitled to have a nuclear weapon and become a superpower and represent the Muslims, not only Iran. It would represent Iran as a nation as well, but the Muslims. And that's the way we should look at what this regime is looking for. It's important because revolutionaries are turbulent by nature. They don't look for some stability. Stability is their enemy. Stability would eternalize the prevailing world order. They want to change it. That's why they need perpetuous turbulence. That's what they need. And we should keep that in mind, because all these efforts to convince the Iranians to support the idea of regional stability are dead on arrival. There's no way the Iranians are going to accept the idea of regional stability. The Iranian regime is essence is to oppose regional stability. This doesn't mean that for a short period of time they cannot adopt steps that would help temporary stability. But their ideology is against it. And this is why, when the situation is dangerous, they would back off, like they did with the agreements they had with the Europeans on the nuclear issue and freezing some of their activities for a while. But they always explain to the Europeans, again and again and again, this doesn't mean that we are going to really put it to an end. It's only for a short period of time and only in return for something that would enable us to move faster once this short period of time would elapse. And this is something that we have to understand. We just don't understand it. We believe that we can convince the Iranians to adopt a policy that would support stability. I don't know why we do that, but somehow that's the way we behave. When we come to our days, not to the ideological roots of all of that, we have to understand that the Iranians work under certain assumptions that, unfortunately, seem to be more or less correct. And if we are to discuss their vulnerabilities, we have to understand what are these assumptions and to see to what extent they are really well-based. First of all, they believe that the West is too weak and too divided to fight for its values and to fight for this plan, this plot. The West has this plot, but is not committed to support it. And that's why Ahmadinejad and some others repeatedly say that there's not going to be a military move against Iran. Because this is almost common knowledge in the Arab world, in the Middle East. The West has lost the stamina that is needed in order to fight wars. It's still fighting some wars, but it's just looking for ways to end them and to run away. And because of that, the West is not going to be involved in a war against Iran. That's the Iranian assumption. Secondly, we are not alone in our initiative to change the world order. Maybe we were a little bit alone at some point in the beginning of the 90s, But for quite a while, we are not alone. And in this policy, we have support from Russia, China, and many other elements within the third world. But especially what's most important is Russia and China. Even the Europeans are not totally happy with the prevailing world order. If the world order states that there's one superpower, nobody likes that. And because of that, nobody's going to support the Americans if they are going to try to impose an American solution to the problem. And this gives us a lot of room to maneuver. We shouldn't be worried too much. The Europeans, in this respect, are not going to really risk their economic interests. Not directly with Iran, and not in a wider perspective. If the prices of oil are going to rise because of growing tension between Iran and the West, the Europeans don't like it. And the Arab frustration is such that you cannot expect the Arabs to really stand against us. They don't like what's happening. They can say all kinds of words. But not only that they're weak, in the end of the day, most of the people in the Arab world would eventually identify with Iran and the confrontation between Iran and the West and would pose such pressure on their governments that the governments would not be able to move against Iran or to support anybody who was going to move against Iran. And because of that, we can continue with our efforts to change the world order. Yes, we are going to face all kinds of pressures. But if we are committed to our goal, we can proceed. Because one of the main ideas, that one main values that we believe in, and that the West doesn't believe in, is that suffering, readiness to suffer, readiness to sacrifice, is something that should be very highly valued. And we should be ready to sacrifice. And we should be ready to suffer. And in this respect, they're ready to suffer economic difficulties and these kind of things. I mean, again, I'm talking about the Iran regime. I'll come to in a minute to the vulnerabilities. Because of that, I think that with all due respect to everything we have done so far in order to put pressure on Iran. And there's a problem here because when we look at what we've done, we are very pleased with what we've done. In the last 5 years since this issue became an international issue, we've moved it from something that nobody even knew anything about, to a focal issue on the international agenda. We have exposed so many new elements of knowledge about the Iranian policy at large and in the nuclear context in particular. And we even managed to have the international community do something about it in the Security Council, which is really impressive. But if you ask yourself from an Iranian point of view, what has happened in the last 5 years? I will tell you, they've managed to cross so many hurdles and reach a situation where they are just on the verge of crossing the last hurdle in spite of all those achievements, nominal achievements of the West. And these are nominal achievements. And nevertheless, since the title is Vulnerabilities, I'll speak about vulnerabilities. The first vulnerability, in my mind, is a potential vulnerability. We don't know yet if it is a vulnerability or not, but it might turn out to be a vulnerability. And this is that it might be that the Iranians don't read correctly the West, and Israel in this respect. That they believe that they can move forward and nothing's going to happen. Their analysis of what the West has done so far is that actually, they don't mean business. While what President Bush has said and what some Israelis have said, that Iran becoming a nuclear power is unacceptable, is actually true. And somebody is going to do something about it if nothing else works. Somebody is going to take real action about this matter and put an end to the Iranian initiative. And we have to say, this kind of mistake was repeatedly done by Islamic radicals in the last few years. Again and again, they've done the same kind of mistake. They believe that the West is hollow, empty, is not going to fight for its values, and the West has surprised them again and again and again. Defensive shield is an extremely good case. The attacks in the attack in Iraq and in Afghanistan is a good case. The kind of way Israel reacted to the kidnapping of the soldiers in Lebanon is another good case of that. And Nasrallah admitted that he made a mistake in this respect. He said, well, I didn't believe they were going to do something like that. Had I known, I wouldn't have started doing it in the first place. I mean, the radicals have this dogma, and it's very difficult for them to understand that at some point, there is a straw that breaks the West's back, and it does react. So it might be that they are wrong. Unfortunately, until now, I cannot say that they are right, that they are wrong in this respect. That's for the time being, I think they are right. The second issue that is really a make or break in this respect is the issue of Russia. Are they right in the way they read Russia or not? Because most of their analysis is based on Russia. And it's not a surprise that they keep going to Russia and sending delegations to Russia every fortnight. They believe that the Russians will always stand at their side and would prevent a resolution in the Security Council that would make it possible for the United States to strike Iran or to take really severe economic measures. It's hard to say. The Russians, on the one hand, are really the Russians that the Iranians see. They do not dance to the American flute on that issue. And they have interests in Iran, and they sell them arms. And they have supported the Iranians in giving them the excuse to which they cling in order to explain why they have a legitimacy to have a nuclear capability. At the same time, Russia is not that stable on that issue. And it's not only the Iranians that send delegations to Russia. The rest of the world sends delegations to Russia as well. There's a reason to believe that the Russians may at one point change their mind, and they did. And the trend we've seen recently, and I think Undersecretary Barnes referred to that yesterday, the trend that we see recently is that the Russians are moving very slowly, not full-heartedly, in the direction of cooperating with the West on the Iranian issue. Is that going to be to the extent that the West needs them? I doubt very much. Basically, I think the Iranians are right on the Russian issue. But it's a vulnerability because so much is built under Russian policy. And we have to understand in this respect that we have to double our efforts in order to explain to the Russians what are the implications of a nuclear Iran. Third, the domestic front in Iran is not united on this issue. Although the Iranians are making an enormous effort to create the impression that there is only one voice coming from Iran on the nuclear issue, this is not the case. Coming back to what I said in the beginning about the arguments between nationalists and revolutionaries, the nationalists understand that there is much at stake, and that if they make any mistake on the first two assumptions that I mentioned, the price that Iran is going to pay, even if there's not going to be a military move, but only an economic move, economic sanctions, is going to be too high and eventually would erode the stability of the revolutionary regime. I'm talking about the nationalists within the regime. It's not the nationalists, many people in Iran who don't support the regime altogether. And the more pressure you put on Iran, these arguments and disagreements are bound to surface. If not, some of them even surface publicly, and if not, they surface in the discussions within the bodies in Iran that have to consider this matter. And there's a lot of tension over there. The fact that for public consumption they try to create the impression that everything is all right, we shouldn't be misled by that. There's a lot of tension inside the Iranian regime on those issues. Because the Iranian regime has to respond to its constituency inside Iran and make sure that life are reasonable. And life are not that easy in Iran, you know. It's needless to say. So there's a lot of tension inside Iran. Now, for the time being, it's not at a level where this can immediately turn into an open debate, open clashes, let alone open clashes. Why? Because most Iranians don't want to go to the streets in order to do something and change the Iranian policy. The price of that is too high. They have already been through one revolution, and it cost them a lot. So they don't want to, not that easy under revolutionary or counter-revolutionary trigger. But as the pressures mount, the tendency grows. The third vulnerability, sorry, the fourth vulnerability, is that it lies with Iran's self-perception. Iran is not North Korea. It's not an isolated country that is motivated by some economic needs. As I explained before, they have some ideas about their place in the world. They want to be part of the world that they want to reshape, but they want to be a part of it. And moreover, economically, they cannot afford behaving like some island. It is not. Iran is very deeply dependent on its economic relations with the rest of the world. Needless to say, even when it comes to feeding the people and when it comes to making the oil industry work, and even when it comes to having the derivatives of petroleum available to the population, all of these things, I don't even mention the one thing that many people deal with, and which is the dependence on the international financial system. For all these reasons, Iran is highly dependent on international economic relations. They cannot ignore the world. Sometimes, as I said before, they say to themselves, well, the Europeans are even more edgy on those issues than we are. They are afraid to lose Iran more than we are afraid to lose them. But the fact of the matter, of course, is that the world depends much, much less on Iran. The world's dependence on Iran is residual, while Iran is very, very heavily dependent on the world. And it's not that they don't know that, even though they would try to make the impression that they don't care, they don't mind. They do care, and they do mind, and they do understand the sensitivities. So this is the fifth element, economic dependence. And the sixth that I would mention is that they have a problem in the region. By the way, there's a big difference in the way the region is being looked upon from Tehran and the way the region looks at Iran. It's two different things. When the Iranians look at the region, they see in it mainly radicals or conservatives. Or radicals and those who cooperate with the West. That's the way they look at the region. They don't see that strongly the colors of Shiites and Sunnis or Arabs and Iranians. There is, of course, these are elements that are there in the Iranian policy, but they're not the main elements according to which Iran judges the region. That's why for the Iranians, they don't find any problem in supporting Fatah, elements in Fatah that are ready to fight, not Abu Mazen. But they don't find any problems in supporting Fatah, in supporting popular resistance committees, in supporting, of course, Islamic Jihad, and in supporting Hamas, who are all very good Sunni organizations. For them, there's no problem with supporting Sunni organizations as long as they are ready to fight the West and Israel. And they can support, by the way, in Iran, both sides. As long as they fight the Americans, it's all right. They can support the Al-Qaeda elements, and they can support the Shiite elements at the same time, as long as they fight the Americans. And the Shiites, they support also because they are Shiites. But that's the way they look at the world. There are some elements in the region who have emphasized the fact that the Iranians are foreigners, ajami, as they call it in Arabic, and that they are Shiites. They might support the Shiites, and because of that, for those elements in the region, well, mainly, let's be honest on that, well, mainly those who cooperate with the West and with the Americans, for them, looking at the world in this way sounds a nice way to, say, mobilize all the elements that would try and help stop the Iranians from moving forward, mainly because they are radicals, not because they are really Ajamis or Shiites. Mainly because they are radicals. And but the fact of the matter is that the region is a problem for the Iranians, because this idea that this is a Shiite-Sunni rift that we are dealing with right now has gained momentum of itself, even though it was created by for a reason in my mind. It doesn't matter. It has gained momentum of itself. And it's now playing its role in the way the region behaves. And this creates more and more difficulties for the Iranians. The possibility of cooperation between Israel and such elements and so on and so forth is causing more troubles for Iran, especially if we get to the point where some steps are going to be taken actually against the Iranians. And at that point, the region might play an important role in putting more pressure over Iran. Putting all of that together, I must say that the Iranians can live with all of that and move forward. The one thing that is really going to be important is to what extent real military action is going to be considered by those who can use military action in order to cope with the Iranian threat. Because the Iranian threat is multidimensional, but at the end of the day, it's mainly the question of whether they're going to break through forward on the issue of the Iranian nuclear project. And the Iranians are not going to stop just because there is economic pressure. The Iranians are not going to stop just because the Saudis don't like the fact that Iran is moving forward and they threaten to produce, and the Egyptians threaten to produce their own nuclear capability. The Iranians are not going to stop just because the Russians would tell them again in the 1 millionth time, listen, this is not nice what you're doing. All of this is not going to convince the Iranians. The point from the Iranian point of view is whether what they're doing, which is supposed to promote the revolution, which is supposed to bring about a change in the world order, whether is this going to serve as a boomerang and hit themselves and threaten the stability of the revolutionary regime. That's the main issue for the Iranians. As long as they believe that this is not the case, they would move forward. If they believe that this is the case, they would rethink about it. And we saw it with the British sailors when they weren't quite sure whether there's a real threat here or not. They didn't take the chance. I'm not saying that the soldiers are as important as the nuclear project, but it's an indication of the Iranian way of thinking. And that's why I think that we have to understand the main vulnerability of Iran is on the military level. They don't have an answer. With all due respect to the weapons they've produced and the capabilities they've bought from the Russians and all of that, Iran is vulnerable militarily. That's the main vulnerability. They cannot really project power the way they would like to. They've built, they invested quite a lot in building some carriers, land carriers, like Lebanon, a land carrier like what they have, the power they have in Iraq, land carriers all over the world that with people that support Hezbollah and are ready to carry out terror attacks if they are mobilized for that purpose. There are some carriers all over the world, but these are in no way to be put in the same order of battle like the American order of battle. It's nothing of the kind. They know that. I mean, they can cause a lot of trouble, but a lot of damage. But they cannot prevent the world from hitting them really hard. That they know. And that's their main vulnerability. That's why they shout all the time, because you know, it's a well-known story from 48 in Israel, where one of the politician reads a speech, and it says, at this point you should speak really loudly because the arguments are not very good. So that's why the Iranians all the time shout that if anybody would dare to hit them, they would do all kinds of terrible things. Well, we know what kind of terrible things they can do. They are terrible, but they're not in any way to be comparable with the implications of Iran going nuclear. That's 10 times worse than anything else the Iranians can do. And because of that, the Iranians understand that, and understand this is the main vulnerability. All in all, if you add up all these vulnerabilities, what I can say is that if the Iranians would consider seriously that there is a possibility of a military move against them, all the list of the other vulnerabilities and the way the West is going to use them might be effective. If not, the effectiveness of these tools is going to be much lesser. I'm not saying that they're not going to be effective. They're going to be effective, but much less than if it's going to be connected to a military threat. That's the situation with the Iranians right now about their vulnerabilities. And just this last sentence, I would say that we have to remember in this respect, the purpose of the entire activities of the Iranians on all fields is to promote the revolution, change the world order, and at the same time, on a defensive level, protect the revolution from the dangers it is facing. And this tension is something that they have to overcome. And as Rafsanjani just recently re-disseminated the words of Khomeini when he decided to stop the war, there are points in time where you take off the ideas of revolution because you are under pressure. And that's if Khomeini can do that, Khamenei and Ahmadinejad obviously can do that. Question.
Can everyone identify themselves for the record when you speak into the microphone?
Hannah Beres from the BBC Latin American Service. Yossi, if I understand you properly, the main thing would be not necessarily reaching a point in which the West will launch a military attack, but the Iranian perception regarding the possibility that the West might do it. First, I would like to be sure if...
Yes, you're right.
That would be the... Okay. A few months ago, I think 2 months ago, Netanyahu was here, and he told us in the same forum that contrarily to what he thought we might think of his perceptions, of his positions, he thinks that the world should not rush to military means, that there's a lot to do in the economic field, the economic arena, to be effective in order to dissuade Iran from its plans. What do you think about it?
Well, here you bring me to something that is makes all this analysis much more problematic, and this is the issue of a timetable. What's the problem? We don't know how much time is it going to take for the Iranians to cross the last hurdle on the way to having all the technological know-how needed in order to produce a nuclear bomb. We know that they have been working on this issue for 13 months now. Since January 9th, 2006, they've been working on that. This is their efforts in Natanz, the R&D that they do in Natanz in enriching uranium. Reasonable assessment of that would say that scientists of the level that the Iranians have, and they have good scientists, not extremely brilliant, but pretty good, can, within this amount of time, considering the fact that the basic knowledge about how to build a centrifuge was given to them by somebody, they don't have to start from scratch. This is a long enough time in order to overcome the problems that you have to overcome if you want to enrich uranium robustly. It seems that the Iranians have not yet completed that effort. It seems so. Otherwise, they would have, Ahmadinejad has already made all kinds of announcements in the last few months that next week, next month, I'm going to make a terrible announcement. And but he never did this announcement, which is an indication that they've not yet managed to get there. But we have to understand, this is imminent. It's a matter of weeks, months. If you are extremely lucky, a year. That's the time frame we are facing. It's not years before they cross this hurdle. It's always a matter of whether you buy or sell. Those who want to sell tell you that, but they're not going to have a weapon before 4 to 9 years. That's true. Once you cross the hurdle, you still have to produce the uranium. So you can still operate at that time. But what's the problem here? Once you know how to do it, even if we destroy the, force them and convince them to give up, don't destroy, just convince them to give up. At any given time, they can go back at some place we don't know and enrich uranium. Had we managed to be determined enough to stop it and prevent them from starting the conversion of uranium, we would have been in a different situation. But today, since they crossed the conversion, and we all were silent on that, they already have, according to their announcements, 250 tons of UF6. 250 tons of UF6, depending on how efficient their process of enrichment is. But let's say, as I said before, that they are pretty good, but not brilliant. Okay, they will take 30 tons of UF6 in order to produce one bomb. Although you can do it also with 20. But I'll be large with them. It's still nine. They have enough raw materials for eight bombs. It's That's where we stand right now. And the conversion facility in Isfahan keeps working. They didn't put it to a halt. It goes on working and producing more and more UF6s. That's why the timetable here is really problematic. And we cannot say it's going to take 4 to 9 years. It's going to take a short time before the Iranians manage to overcome this hurdle that they are trying to overcome already for certain months. Now, if I would be mistaken, which I cannot, there's no reason to believe that I'm going to be mistaken, and the Iranians are not pretty good, but pretty lousy, and they're never going to overcome this hurdle. That's great. That's just great. I hope it's the case. But this would be basing your entire policy on a wishful thinking. This is going to be totally irresponsible in my mind to base the entire policy on some wishful thinking that the Iranians will never manage to overcome this problem. And again, I tell you, they don't start from scratch. So economic sanctions have this nature of taking a long time before they mature, before they bear the fruits that you want them to bear. And that's why I'm not at all sure that the economic sanctions at this stage are that relevant for the problem we are dealing with, because of the question of the timetable. Had we gone to these economic sanctions three years ago, this could have been a good idea. But we cannot put ourselves in a time tunnel or something like that. But, we are now. We are here. And that's the big problem. Now, we can wait for the last moment of establishing and putting everything together and really producing the bomb. But this is we shall be always exposed to the threat that tomorrow there's going to be another one. If they don't have the technology, it's a different situation. I'm afraid that on this one, we might lose the train. But the way it looks now, there's a big danger that we might lose the train on this one.
Look, when you say we, I would like to understand better what you mean, because, you know, Europe, you describe their attitude quite correctly, and this is what they are. They don't mean to do a thing, mostly in the field that you were describing now. As long as it is a sanction, even low sanction, as they won't go beyond it. America, Bush is busy with the Iraq now, very, very busy, because they're going to vote to pull out, when is it, today or tomorrow? So what's left is Israel now. I mean, if we want to be very realistic and standing with our feet on the ground.
Difficult questions, boy. you know, this the world has for a long time now developed this idea that, and this is, by the way the Iranians look at it as well, that, okay, if worst come to worst, we got Israel. They'll do it. They did it in 81, very efficiently. Just consider where the world would have been had we not attacked the Iraqi Osirak reactor. And they do it whenever we need them. They are there for us. And they can do the dirty job. I think in this case this is going to be a mistake. I wouldn't say a terrible mistake, but a mistake to believe that Israel has to do it, or would have to do it eventually. As I explained, the threat of the Iranians is to the world order. This is what they have in mind. Yes, in their mind, Israel is a part of that world order, and one of the first moves you have to do in changing the world order is to get rid of Israel. That's why they are so busy in dealing with the Holocaust, because they believe that the Holocaust is the legitimacy upon which the state of Israel is based. And if they can erode this legitimacy, then they can take care of Israel, and then it would be possible for them to move forward in their efforts to change the world. And but Israel is not the ultimate target, not even militarily. They are building their forces in a way that would enable them to threaten Europe directly. That's why they are so heavily engaged in efforts to build long-range missiles that can carry nuclear weapons and reach Europe itself. Even today, they can reach Berlin with a missile, and if they have a nuclear warhead, they can reach Berlin with a nuclear warhead. I haven't checked about Rome, I must say that. I have to. But I guess if they reach Berlin, they reach Rome. Yes, so it's that's where we stand. Do you feel very comfortable sitting in Rome and knowing that an Iranian nuclear missile can hit your head? I wouldn't be. Okay, I know. I explained it. But we is the world, because the question at stake is, to what extent are we ready to defend our values, not only our security? Security is one of our values. We believe that we have to be secured. But it's not the only thing we believe in. And what we fight for here, and I mean the West, what the West is fighting for here, is the set of values that we believe in. Now, we, especially the Europeans, that's true what you're saying. They say, well, we'll give this kind of small concession. It's not really important. And we'll gain two more weeks of quiet. This is a dangerous move. That's why I think that the world has to come up. Now, what we've seen so far is that the world understands that, basically. It doesn't mean that it acts this way, but the fact that the world, the Security Council, have voted for sanctions against Iran is a manifestation of this understanding. How far would anybody go on that? Yes, you know, people were saying it at a certain, several years ago, people were saying to us, yes, you know, but you're right, it's terrible if they have a nuclear weapon, but, you know, if we move, if we take even an economic sanction against them, the oil prices might rise, and who knows, we might have $50 per barrel. Today we have $60 per barrel, and the world still functions. And we have to understand, if we are not going to show any readiness to suffer, the Iranians will be correct. This is their idea. These guys are not ready to suffer. We are ready to suffer. That's why we're going to be victorious. And that's a test and a challenge for the entire world, not only for the state of Israel. State of Israel, I don't know if the world is going to fail in this test. Israel is going to be facing a very difficult decision that it would have to make. But at this point, the ball is in the world's court, the West's court, and they have to decide what they're going to do in that. And it's, in my mind, it's going to be a very big mistake on behalf of Israel if it's going to say, if you don't, then we are going to do it. Because this is going to enable the world to just skip the challenge and let the Israelis do it again for us. This is going to be a mistake, because you have to face yourself in the mirror and ask yourself. It's all of us together. We have to look at the mirror and say, are we ready to fight for our values or not? That's the question. The answer, as you say, unfortunately, is that most people in the West are saying, no, we are not ready to fight. That's terrible.
Johannes Gerloff, Christian Media Association, KEP Germany. I would like to know, considering all what we said so far, would Israel be able to prevent Iran militarily from going nuclear, considering also the distances, the geopolitical situation, and also I think the Iranians have learned a lot from Oz-Iraq?
Well, it's not an Oz-Iraq case for sure. It's a different situation. And I cannot answer you in yes or no. What I can say is that Israel understands that it has to build itself and build its capabilities to be able to do that. It has understood that for a while. It has invested money in all the elements that would make it more possible for Israel to do it, because Israel understand too that the West might fail in this test that it is going through right now. So Israel cannot afford not being ready for something like that. And that's why Israel is investing in long-range airplanes and all of that. We build the capability. I'm not going to tell you yes or no, of course. But that's where we stand. Obviously, the difficulties that you mentioned are there. The distance, the disperse of the sites, the way they are built was underground. There's a lot of difficulties. It's not it's not carrying out an attack in Gaza. It's much more complicated. We build ourselves as well as we can in order to be able to do that. If the West is going to do that, they are going to have a much easier task. A much easier task. And they can do it, in my mind. They can do it much, much easier.
Why? What do you mean?
They don't have to go through all the difficulties we have. They can bring in some weapons closer to Iran. They have enough weapons to repeatedly attack Iran if necessary. I mean, from some military analysis will tell you that the West can, especially, of course, the United States, but I would argue that it would be much better. It's going to be a world effort, not an American effort. It can be done relatively easy. And if it's, and my feeling is that if the West is going to say that it is considering it, it won't need to do it. Because the Iranians would not take the risk of putting the West into a test if they really mean it.
I'm going to use the privilege of the chairman to ask a question. How would you compare the situation of Iraq in the 1990s, the situation of Iran today from the standpoint of vulnerability? The United Nations tried to use economic sanctions against Iraq for... how many years? 1991 till
12 years.
And they couldn't get Saddam Hussein to cooperate with UNSCOM to demonstrate to the world that he did not have weapons of mass destruction. So the question is, if the use of economic leverage against Iraq did not work in the 1990s, why should economic leverage have any value vis-a-vis Iran now?
I fully agree with you. I don't think that economic sanctions by themselves can make the world. Economic sanctions, if they are accompanied by a real military threat, are something totally different. And what happened with Iraq is that the fact that the Iraqis understood from what happened in 91 that there is not going to be an invasion into Iraq proper enabled them to go through all the suffering of the economic sanctions for so many years. And the only thing that made them reveal the secrets of what they had was the defection of Hossein Kamel and the stories about the about what they hide in the Khomlulim, whatever.
Maybe it's the fact that they have multiple centers of power in Iran, and there were no multiple centers of power.
It's not going to. It's of course every case is unique. Right. So, but in general, the government in Iran is in the hands of the most radical elements. The government in Iran is in the hands of the Revolutionary Guards. They are crazy zealots who are not going to give up on anything. They made sure that Ahmadinejad is going to be the president, so that even the one position in the government that was held by their contenders was taken away from them and given to the radicals. The parliament went through a process of radicalization that actually leaves all positions in Iran in the hands of the radicals, to the extent that the radical of yesterday, Khamenei, all of a sudden became the most reasonable person in Iran. That's the process we see in Iran. It's the regime is very committed to the regime is very committed to the radical philosophy and the ideology, and that's why I don't think that they really listen to are going to listen to what some supporters of Khatami or some people who are totally against the regime are going to say. They're not really impressed by that. They're impressed by one thing. What is the West really going to do? To what extent can we rely on Russia? How difficult the economic sanctions are going to be? These are things that they look at the other side and say, look there. I mean, as I said before, I'm not underestimating totally the fact that there is some internal problems. There are, and they should be used and exploited as much as we can. But in order to magnify the way we can exploit these tensions, we have to present the Iranians with some real threats. Otherwise, this by itself is not going to be enough. And the Iraqi case is a very good example of how these things don't work. And, when it's only when Saddam understood that the world means business that he has started doing something in order to was ready to let the inspectors back to Iraq. Yeah, that's what made him understand that he should let the inspectors back in October of 2002. Not the economic sanctions.
Last question, Chaya Hershkovitz, our Director General.
Having heard all that about the dangers of Iran, the dangers to the West, I was wondering about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, how that figures in all this equation. We all know that Israel is supposed to make concessions to bring stability to the area and to maybe to pacify Iran and countries. What is your view about possible resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Would that make any difference in Iran's attitude to Israel and the world?
Well, I obviously think that if we could bring about some sort of settlement with the Palestinians, this would be highly recommended to do so, and there's no better timing than right now. If this was possible, yes, this would be something that would make the Iranian life worse and makes things more complicated for them. Unfortunately, the situation is just quite the opposite, I would say. We are not in a point where it's just up to us to decide whether we want to have an agreement with the Palestinians or not. The Palestinians are governed by the Hamas, who are working with the Iranians, support the same ideas. They are a splinter of the Muslim Brotherhood, who are basically the Sunni equivalent of the Iranian regime. And that's what these guys are looking for. They also want to change the world. And because of that, I think that it would be some sort of illusionizing ourselves to believe that we can now reach an agreement with the Palestinians. Of course, if we can pacify the situation with the Palestinians, it's always better than have rockets falling on your heads and suicide bombers exploding in your cities. But it raises again the question that is much deeper. And in my mind, this is one of the most important questions we have to ask ourselves. When is the right time to do something about an emerging threat? We've been through it with Hezbollah, and we've been through it with the Iraqi threat and the Iraqi nuclear program, and we now face it with Iran, also with the Palestinians, by the way. And there's always this question, when do you move? Now, according to our values, we never move before we are harshly provoked. That's because we need the kind of agreement we have with our citizens is that not only the Israelis, it's the entire Western world. The kind of agreement we have with our citizens is such that we don't put them in jeopardy unless there is no other way of handling the matter. And our enemies take advantage of this situation and develop all kinds of weapons and capabilities because they, as I said in the beginning, they are turbulent by nature. They don't intend to produce and equip themselves with these weapons just for the sake of being strong. They mean to use them. And we stand and look and try all kinds of political and best economic tools in order to cope with the problem, which are, we should already learn the lesson. These tools do not work. And we have to ask ourselves a policy, something much deeper at the highest world level. What is going to be the policy on this issue? Are we going to just stand by and look at the Iranians develop the weapons of mass destruction? That's the question here. And if we could make peace with everybody of them, it would be great, but they don't want peace with us. And let me just, you know, to sum it up. I said in the beginning, the question is, what is justice? For them, justice is when we don't exist. They don't justify our existence here. For them, justice is when we don't exist here. As a state, they don't mind if we live in Europe. That's justice. Now, we cannot accept this kind of logic about justice. And they don't even hide it. They say it out loudly. Just saw this paper that Doris prepared about whether this is incitement for a genocide. One thing is obvious. They don't think that we should exist here. So we have to bear that in mind when we think about the way they develop their capabilities. It's inconvenient, and it's much better to wait and see. It's always better. But we have to understand that there are risks in waiting and waiting to see.
Well, thank you, General Cooperwasser. I think you've brought us a lot of the different vectors and elements that are affecting the region around this question of Iran and the vulnerabilities of Iran and what the West can do. And it seems to come back to some very hard decisions that are going to have to be taken. I guess our next event is my event for ICA, which is on May 8th at the King David Hotel, where I'm going to be sort of unveiling my new book to the Israeli and foreign press public called The Fight for Jerusalem. It's appropriate timing because it's a week before the Jerusalem Day, and we're commemorating 40 years of the reunification of Jerusalem. So if you haven't gotten an invitation, we can